Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. What if they signed a treaty, but nobody cared? The two treaties signed at the Earth Summit will likely be ratified by each signing nation, but who will enforce compliance? An environmental lawyer will join us this time with some answers. Also, Dr. Sabina O'Hara of the National Council of Churches at the summit with some impressions and expressions of how important each of us can be in what we do and what we say. And Kansas City, the first city in the nation to achieve clean air. How do they do it? Here's one way.
All employers of 50 or more persons were contacted with information about how to sponsor rideshare programs and flexible work hours, and different types of strategies that would help reduce emissions during the ozone season.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. President Bush and the official U.S. delegation to the recently concluded Earth Summit received the brunt of international criticism for not signing the Biodiversity Treaty and for agreeing to sign the Global Climate Treaty, but only after forcing major compromising changes in the text. Nevertheless, with most of the participating nations signing on to both treaties, the documents have now been carried back to each nation's government for ratification. But the question seldom asked and never answered is, assuming these treaties become international law, what legal procedures are in place to enforce the laws? Would a U.S. citizen have the right to sue the U.S. government should a violation occur? Would, say, a citizen of France or Kenya or the island nation of Vanuatu be able to sue the U.S. government? Would a U.S. citizen be able to sue the government of, say, Norway or Nepal or Bolivia for violations? Attorney Robert Hausman at the Center for International Environmental Law in Washington says these are questions for which we have a wide range of possible answers.
When the U.S. signs an agreement, when President Bush signed the Global Warming Agreement, that has a certain degree of authority in the United States, albeit limited. The next step is the ratification process and the implementation process, where that international agreement is implemented into domestic law. Once that occurs, there is no differentiation between that law, that requirement, that mandate that stems from an international agreement, and one that comes directly from the grassroots of the United States through the Congress and the Senate and into the U.S. Code.
And incidentally, we should mention at this point that in that process, it is the Senate as the congressional body that does the work and the ratification, and,
right.
And not both houses together.
Right, with international agreements, that's correct. Once the agreement is implemented into U.S. law, it's the law of the land.
Hausman cites as an example the Montreal Protocol, much of which is now subsumed within the Clean Air Act. But the question remains, who has the right to enforce? In the Clean Air Act, there is a citizen suit provision included. But what about international action?
It's difficult. It's very difficult. What we have right now is there's only four or five ways that countries interact and force each other's behavior. You know, there's the exchange of diplomatic letters and the usual international relations. The way that most of these agreements work that are really binding and truly enforceable is they include trade provisions. For example, the Montreal Protocol bans trade at certain points with non-parties. It also includes provisions that cover trade amongst the parties. Now, this is also noteworthy because there's a tremendous issue in international circles as to whether or not trade should be used, trade measures should be used to enforce environmental laws. There was a recent GATT tuna dolphin panel decision, international arbitration panel, under the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, said that a United States law that also applied extraterritorially, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, using trade measures, was a violation of the U.S.'s obligations under the GATT, and therefore the U.S. should go back. It doesn't require, in other words, it can't force the United States to go back on its own law, and to remove the trade measures. What's troubling about this is if you say that you can't use trade measures, there enforceable measures that can be put in place to coerce or to encourage a foreign party to follow the international law.
What seems clear from this, then, is that the drafters of these new treaties are assuming, or perhaps hoping, that each nation signing the treaty would voluntarily adhere to the terms of the treaty. What seems equally clear is that, in this arena alone, the Earth Summit and the function of the United Nations is truly testing new waters, designing a new world where military might is being replaced by environmental and social health, and where disputes are settled by peaceful negotiations. Robert Hausman is a practicing attorney with the Center for International Environmental Law in Washington, and this is Bruce Robertson. While government agencies around the world edit the final versions of the treaties, statements, and position papers generated at the recent United Nations Earth Summit, delegates arriving home have stories to tell and memories to share. In many cases, these impressions are as significant an outcome of the summit as are the treaties and position papers themselves. Dr. Sabina O'Hara, an NGO, or non-governmental organization, representative, attended both the preparatory committee meetings at the UN earlier this spring and then the summit itself as a representative of the United Methodist Church, the National Council of Churches, and the World Council of Churches. O'Hara reminds us that the summit was not limited to the official gathering of world leaders.
Parallel to this official summit, there was what was called the Global Forum, which took place closer to the downtown area of Rio on Flamengo Beach. And there is a park on that beach area, Flamengo Park, and that's where 35 tent structures and some 600 and some booths and exhibits of different non-governmental organizations were put together, a huge gathering of an estimated 14,000 grassroots and social movements who gathered there to exchange ideas, to be a visible presence to the official summit and to network and learn from each other.
This event was several years in the planning. It was over, though, in 2 weeks. What was it like to be immersed in such a fast-paced international mix of people and events?
It certainly was an exciting experience. Rio itself is a beautiful city, right on the beach with beautiful sandy beaches and really spectacular surf at some of the beaches, and surrounded by mountains, just a spectacular, beautiful surrounding in which this whole gathering took place. However, very visible too in Rio is the poverty, which is, of course, throughout all of South America and large parts of our world that we are less aware of here in the developed, so-called developed North. And that was very visible too.
Did you get any sense that officials were trying to hide these aspects of their city?
Well, the city was cleaned up, as we were told. And I was told, for example, by a Brazilian woman that at the Hotel Gloria, which was sort of the non-governmental organization center right across the street from the Flamengo Beach area. And this woman told me that usually in front of the Hotel Gloria, you cannot walk without stepping over street people and primarily street children. And that was certainly cleaned up. We were told that many of them had been taken to the northern part of the city, and that camps had been built for the street children. They were supplied with food and so forth from some of the social service organizations, the local ones, some of the churches. And actually, throughout the course of the conference, there was some thought, some reflection of the fact that maybe these camps should be made into permanent structures to deal with the problem of street children and of blatant poverty in Rio.
The Earth Summit resulted in the signing of two legally binding treaties, one on climate change, often referred to as the Global Warming Treaty. The other treaty would protect the world's biodiversity. The United States fought for and won significant modifications in the climate change treaty and did not sign the biodiversity treaty at all. The summit also resulted in a huge publication called Agenda 21, which you might think of as a blueprint for how the other treaties will be implemented. Almost at the last minute, the United States submitted a fourth proposal to protect Earth's forests. Finally, there was the Rio Declaration, which some had seen as a sort of constitution, a broad statement of purpose and commitment to long-term goals. Assessing the Earth Summit, many considered the meeting to be a relative failure, given that the climate change treaty was so changed from its original structure, and given that the United States did not sign the biodiversity treaty. O'Hara speaks for others, however, when she says this summit will have an impact on the future.
Just the fact that there was this enormous gathering of, I don't know, 160-some nations, I think it ended up being the sum total of delegations which gathered surrounding these summit negotiations, that in the treaties it states that the environment is a concern, that we have global environmental issues to deal with, that we have recognized are of importance to us on an international basis, that impact on Africa, for example, where the desert is growing, on Latin America, where the rainforests are being depleted at the rate of one football field every 2 seconds, and the enormous loss of species that is connected with that. The fact that it is the industrialized nations which have clearly contributed to problems of global warming, for example, by emitting major amounts of greenhouse gases into our common global atmosphere. So we have at least mapped out some of the issues. We have recognized them, and we have recognized the problem. And I think that will have an impact in the future. And if I look at the United Nations disarmament negotiations and how long they have been going on, and finally after 25 years or so, we are getting somewhere, so that I'm optimistic that we're going to be getting somewhere on these environmental issues. And maybe it was somehow naive of us to think that we could do it all in one set of preparatory conferences and in one Earth summit.
Dr. Sabina O'Hara recently returned from the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. She attended as a representative of the United Methodist Church, the National Council of Churches, and the World Council of Churches. In fact, one of her most enduring memories, she tells us, concerns an evening visit she had with a Methodist congregation from Brazil, during which she saw clearly the power and the importance of our individual efforts.
The average income of this congregation was $70 a month. And they were asking us, what are you doing here? What does what you do there have to do with us? How will it affect our lives? And we shared some around the questions of affluence and poverty and how do our lifestyles impact the environment. And one of the women said, you know, when you state the concern about the rainforests and when you state your concern about us not having to give up our own plants and animals and resources for nothing in exchange, that makes me hopeful that other people from other parts of the world should be concerned and interested about what goes on with us and how we are suffering under the economic situation here in Brazil. So that remark has certainly been with me and continues to be with me. How do I, as a person, affect this enormous issue of global environmental issues and issues of interrelatedness and interconnectedness, and that's probably the most important thing that I hope to communicate in some way, that the ecology teaches us that we're interconnected over space and over time, and we have to learn to live accordingly.
This is Bruce Robertson. An old blues song said it.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come.
Well, now you might want to go too. Hot, muggy summer in the city can be more than uncomfortable. The heat mixed with air pollution often results in unhealthful air, air with high readings of ground-level ozone. In fact, to monitor air quality, the Federal Clean Air Act requires cities to measure the amount of ozone at several points around town every day. And a checkpoint station is allowed only one reading of smog above the EPA guideline limit. If a higher reading happens twice within 3 years, the city is placed on a list of cities considered in violation of EPA regulations. Fines and penalties follow if the city fails to comply. Well, such frustration was often faced in the cities of Kansas City, Kansas, and Missouri. The two cities worked together for 14 years to meet the EPA emission standards. And finally, late this spring, Kansas City became the largest metropolitan region in the nation to reach what is called attainment, or compliance, with the EPA. Carol Adams is air quality coordinator for the Mid-America Regional Council, a group which includes representatives from both cities. Despite the complicated input from the two cities, two states, and the federal government, Adams says the council was able to come up with a good plan.
The governments in the region organized several different kinds of specific efforts. One of the efforts was called an ozone reduction campaign, and that was conducted every summer. And all employers of 50 or more persons were contacted with information about how to sponsor rideshare programs and flexible work hours and different types of strategies that would help reduce emissions during the ozone season.
But Adams says the biggest sacrifices came from the business community. For years, new or expanding industries had to meet the lowest achievable emission rate. That meant finding and implementing the best technology on the market. And according to Adams, many businesses suffered because of the costs of this new technology. But now that the region has met the EPA regulations, Adams says the community has begun to balance environmental protection with the economic needs of a corporation struggling to comply.
Now they can use the best available emissions technology, which allows some consideration for cost, as opposed to the lowest achievable emissions rate, which allowed no consideration for the cost effectiveness of the technology. What they do is look at what other similar industries that are well controlled are doing. And the assumption is that if other well controlled industries can make a profit doing this, then that same industry in any community should be able to control their emissions at least to that level.
In fact, Adams credits the business community for giving the city the final boost it needed to meet the requirements. After trying to find some changes in emissions which would secure the attainment, Adams says city officials decided to approach the oil companies.
We looked at several different alternatives, and the alternative that appeared to be most cost-effective was to lower the evaporative characteristic of fuel. At the time that this was discussed, there wasn't enough time left in the year to go through the full legislative process that would have been required for the states to enact rules to require less evaporative fuel. So it was decided that we would approach the oil suppliers and ask for their voluntary cooperation in this effort. With the help of the Chamber of Commerce, the oil suppliers were convened, and they agreed to voluntarily reduce the evaporative characteristic of fuel to the Kansas City region during the summer of 1990.
Adams says it is more expensive for oil companies to produce these fuels because the new refining techniques result in less gasoline and more butane per barrel of oil. According to Adams, transportation pollution created about 50% of Kansas City's ground-level ozone. But she says new federal regulations for more efficient cars and better quality gasoline will help. These improvements are included in the city's 10-year maintenance plan, a plan required by the Clean Air Act of 1990, under which all cities must describe the methods by which they will maintain their clean air designation. Under the program, businesses will get another break. Before the city met the EPA guidelines, any new or expanding company had to find offsets for its planned emissions. In other words, before a new company would be allowed to emit a new ton of air pollution, that company had to demonstrate where an existing company had reduced its pollutants by one ton. But with the federal government now enforcing new standards to reduce emissions, Adams says offsets are no longer necessary.
When we did our maintenance plan, because we could show that the reduction in mobile source emissions from fuel changes and fleet turnover would result in reductions over the 10-year period, we did not have to keep the offset provision. And so now industries here are able to expand or to come into this area without having to do offsets.
As a result, many are predicting an influx of new businesses into the Kansas City area. But while economic advantages are likely, Adams points out the health benefits are even more important. Smog is an irritant which damages the respiratory system and is especially dangerous for the elderly and people with respiratory diseases. With government officials and industry leaders working to decrease Kansas City's smog, Adams says it is now time for residents to get involved as well.
The place that we're seeing the most growth in emissions and that we feel that we're the most vulnerable long-term is in a category that's called area source emissions. And those emissions come from things that we do every day and consumer choices we make in small businesses. Things like mowing the lawn, recreational boating, charcoal lighter fluid, all fall into the area source category. So what we're trying to do now is we're trying to help people first learn what they do that contributes to air emissions, because a lot of these things are subtle, and I don't think that anyone puts lighter fluid on their charcoal with the idea of contributing to smog. And clearly, it's just not on the top of your mind when you're lighting your grill. So we're trying to get people to become aware of the links between some of those activities and smog formation. And then we hope to work with the Weather Service to eventually be able to alert people to days that have a high potential for smog formation so that they can modify their behavior on those days.
Carol Adams is air quality coordinator for the Mid-America Regional Council in Kansas City, Kansas. While cities all over the country battle ground-level ozone problems, Adams encourages them not to give up, even though some of the worst conditions lie just ahead, aggravated by the sweltering heat of summer. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the program. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. We receive many requests for cassette copies of the Environment Show. If you would like to order a copy of the program, just call 1-800-767-1929. You can order with your Visa or MasterCard if you wish, or pay by check. The operator will give you the information you need. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 130. The phone number, once again, is 1-800-767-1929, program number 130. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, do drop us a line. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Our thanks to this week to Karen Kelly for production work on the Kansas City story. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.